You know that's going in the beginning. Yeah. Well, howdy there, Angela.
Howdy, partner.
What do you know about the Chisholm Trail? What did you know before we started doing this?
Well, not much. I knew it was a trail that went through Texas and Oklahoma. And I would see it on road trips as a little girl.
Yeah, you'd see markers. Historical markers.
I honestly didn't really think about it that much. I knew it was cattle. They were driving cattle. But I never stopped to think of why or how. What did you think? Were you into it when you were a little boy?
No. I never was into cowboy stuff. Although I like rode horse. My friend had some horses. And he did like roping and stuff. So
that's cool.
Would sit out there and like he had a plastic steer thing that he'd practice on.
Okay.
I mean, I was around it. I grew up in Edmond. So my friend had some land and some horses, and I think they had a couple heads of cattle. So what about you? Have you ever gone cowboying?
I don't know what you mean by cowboying, but I have ridden quite a few horses.
Have you ridden a horse? Have you ever like had a horse go like full
run all, a horse?
Yeah, run
yes,
a horse.
I have okay. ran horses.
Terrifying.
I think it's I love yeah. it, but I love being on the back of a motorcycle too. So
okay,
no, I love I like horseback riding. Haven't done it in years and years, but when I was younger, I did go.
I have a healthy fear of large animals, cattle.
Well, I think everybody should have a fear of large animals, but yeah, no, they don't scare me. I trust them, and even though I'm a little bit scared of heights, I have this weird thing where I will trust a horse or a pony more. So I don't mind taking a trail like up a mountain or down a mountain if I'm on the back of a pony or a horse, because I feel like they're more sure-footed than I am. So I guess I actually trust them more than I trust myself.
I'm always
myself.
Fearful of them kicking me.
Oh,
like getting in them. I remember helping my friend get his horses on trailers, and that was terrifying.
Yeah,
like, he's going to kick my face off. Obviously, yeah.
So. That's a little bit different than just
And I had a horse step on my toe, which hurt.
How did a horse step on your toe?
Stepped on my toe. Like,
this is a tiny target for a horse.
Yeah, he didn't move though. He stepped on my toe and like
and
then I
kind of
pushed him and it
kind
of freaked him out. No, it just stepped on my. I mean, it didn't like crush my toe off. But point is I'm slightly scared of livestock. Hand of horses. So. Yeah.
Well, my grandmother and grandfather, my stepdad's, they had a farm in Carnegie, Oklahoma, and they had some cattle. And so I got to be around the cattle. I kind of look at them as like pets, like huge pets. You know, I'm a big animal lover though. So they're big tongues and they're fun. But I never thought about like having to round them up or move them. You know, 1,000 miles, which is insane when you start to really think about it, wrap your brain around.
And I told you we might have a lead on a episode where we milk a cow.
Yes, and I'm very excited about that. I've never milked a cow.
So let's get somebody who really knows the Chisholm Trail in here. My old graduate advisor at UCO, Dr. Kenny Brown. He was also my professor at UCO. He taught for 36 years. He is now professor of history emeritus at UCO and an amazing guy. Who is like an Oklahoma encyclopedia.
Yeah.
He's absolutely incredible. Yeah, he's helped us out with tons of projects. He's a friend of the Historical Society.
One smart dude.
So before we get to Dr. Brown, let's give a mini description of what the Chisholm Trail is. Essentially, the Chisholm Trail was a cattle driving, not road, but a cattle driving trail from Texas to...
Kansas.
Started... Abilene at first, and then moved. The railhead was moved down to Wichita as the rail lines developed. But essentially, it was a cattle driving trail through central Oklahoma.
So they were trying to take the cattle, the huge amount of cattle
from Texas to markets in the east.
Up to the markets. So it's a business.
It is a business. And that's the most interesting thing. This story, I thought it was going to be a lot about cowboys, and it is. And we get to that. And this is a two-parter. So the second part is more about cowboys. But the bulk of this story is a story of economics and weather, climate, geography. It's a whole bunch of, it's much more than just
what meets
cowboy.
The eye as far as,
than just cowboys. So well, let's talk to Dr. Brown and figure out exactly what the Chisholm Trail was. And if you listen carefully, I think he calls me a sissy at some point. So.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Here we go, Dr. Brown. We're here with Dr. Brown. You were my graduate advisor at UCO, and it's great to have you in. Thanks for coming in.
I'm glad to be here.
I have a question. What was Corey like as a student?
Oh, that's...
he was about like he is right now. That's a little scary. Right?
That's a lot scary.
And it's great to see you, but you still, every time I see you, I love talking with you, but you give me a little bit of residual grad school stress kind of comes back.
Oh, really? just by walking
it's,
up?
Yeah, that's, it's just good. Deep down there somewhere.
Still like lingering in there.
A slight nervousness. Well, we're here to talk about the Chisholm Trail, and can you give us a kind of a broad idea of what the Chisholm Trail is and why we even discuss it today?
Yeah, the Chisholm Trail began in 1867, but it was part of a much broader movement right after the Civil War. During the war, because of the economic conditions in Texas, the Longhorn cattle, which had been very numerous even before the war, grew in even larger numbers. And the Texans, after the war, looked at economic opportunity and realized that they could, if they could somehow get the cattle to market in the North or the Midwest, then they could gain about $30 or $40 a head. If they sold it locally, $3 or $4. So the increase in value would be astronomical. So right off the bat, in 1866, a number began rounding up the Longhorns, heading them north on what was called the Sedalia Trail, later also referred to as the Shawnee Trail, with various branches. The original Sedalia or Shawnee Trail was basically the old Texas Road, a north-south trail that had been created prior to the Civil War in Eastern Indian Territory. It had been the main thoroughfare for migrants who were heading from Missouri to Texas. And it follows basically parallel to Highway US 69 and the old MK&T Railroad, the original railroad that built through. But there were problems. One problem was the terrain. It was hilly, lots of creeks and rivers to cross. And when they got to Missouri, the farmers in Missouri were not exactly welcoming because of the Texas fever. They didn't know at the time, but ticks that infested the Texas cattle. The Texas cattle, the Longhorns, had developed an immunity to it. And those ticks, once they got onto other breeds, they would die in large numbers. And so Missouri and Kansas had actually passed laws prior to the Civil War keeping the Texas cattle out. But with the emergency, with the deterioration of conditions, the Texans just ignored that idea and headed toward Sedalia, Missouri. And the Kansas Pacific Railroad had built to that point, heading from an east to west across Missouri and heading toward Kansas. And so they went ahead and took the cattle there. The Missourians sort of ignored the law that had been on the books for a while because they were interested in economic activity as well. But over the next year or so, the Texans began hunting for a possible different route. And then Joseph G. McCoy, a meat dealer who had been involved in the business right off the bat. He was from Illinois. He started working with Kansas Pacific Railroad and made an agreement with them as they moved westward into Kansas. He would get the exclusive right to sell, to purchase and then transport, should say purchase and transport, the cattle that would come to the new little town of Abilene. And so they made the agreement with him. This is what is called a monopsony and economic policy as opposed to a monopoly. A monopoly, you're the only producer of a good. A monopsony, you're the only purchaser of a good. And so it gave him an economic advantage. He spread the word to Texas cattlemen. So instead of going through what is now eastern Oklahoma, they went through central Oklahoma, crossing the Red River and heading north through Chisholm Trail, roughly paralleled U.S. 81, Highway 81 today, and went through the Warika, Duncan area, north through the Chickasha area. There was actually two branches in central Oklahoma when they reached Silver City area near present-day Tuttle. The Chisholm Trail branched into an eastern and western branch. One of them, the eastern branch went through Yukon, and then the western branch went over toward El Reno, Fort Reno.
Why did it branch like that?
Well, part of it had to do with the availability of grass and maybe a preference. You might have two or three herds that had gone through and taken the eastern route, and as the cowboys came up, they saw
not much left.
Not much grass left, because part of the strategy was to fatten the beef as you headed north. Mm-hmm. And so they would branch off. And this happened not in a formal way on a lot of different occasions mm-hmm. where they would spread out and go over a slightly different route. But this one had certain, the eastern branch and the western branch had certain advantages and disadvantages through central Oklahoma. So, but the probably the main one was that once you reach that point where it branch off, if it looked like there was more grass to the west, you might head that way.
So would you just, you'd send out a scout to like look ahead and see what was going on, or how did they kind of figure that out?
Yeah, you probably would send a cowboy ahead and say which one of these is going to be the best. But it, the two branches came back together just north of the Cimarron River at present-day Dover, and then it headed north from there, going through what is now Hennessy and Bison and Waucomas and Enid, and then angling a little bit up toward Caldwell, Kansas. So that was the first town in present-day Kansas where it went through. Now, my wife happens to be from Waucomas, mm-hmm. and the Chisholm Trail went right down what is now Main Street, and or the main thoroughfare of the Chisholm Trail went through the main thoroughfare of the town. And it went right through much of Enid, straight through Enid as well, present day. The reason it ended up being called the Chisholm Trail was not because Jesse Chisholm led these first herds in 1867. There are a lot of people who assume that that is the case, and it's not.
He had passed on before it even got started.
Well, he died in early 1868. The first herds went up in the spring and summer of 1867, so he had been alive for a few months, but by then it had not been named the Chisholm Trail anyway. But he died doing a little ranching himself in the area north of Gary, Oklahoma, in that vicinity south of Watonga. Apparently got some food poisoning and died and is buried in that vicinity. But Jesse Chisholm had been a longtime trader in the area, was involved in a wide variety of different economic activities. He was part Cherokee Indian, moved over the Trail of Tears, settled in what is now the area around Holdenville, which was Creek Indian country at the time, a little bit west of the Cherokees. And he married into the Edwards family. They were a prominent trading family in the area. And they moved a little bit farther west upstream up the Canadian River and established a trading post of his own in the 1830s. And that was near the present-day town of Asher. In fact, my son-in-law happens to own the property, or his family does, own the property where the Chisholm trading post was. There's still a spring house there that he built. It's gone through several different revisions, I'm sure, but I've visited that spring house. When he was in that vicinity, he carried on a number of different economic activities. He apparently had gotten acquainted with Sam Houston over in the Cherokee country when Houston was there for a couple of years. And so when Houston became president and then governor of Texas, Chisholm played a role of negotiating with Indians. He had lived in that Asher region for some time and learned several different Indian languages, Comanche, Kiowa, Wichita, Delaware. He had interacted with various tribes in the area, trading goods for hides and so forth. And he also sold the area where his trading post was along the California Road or California Trail that was used in the 1850s fairly heavily by people heading to California. And he sold goods to them. He went to Texas and helped negotiate various treaties with Indian tribes in Texas. He, on several occasions, went to Washington, D.C., and negotiated for the federal government with tribes in the area as well. So he was an interpreter, a diplomat. He led expeditions to various places with a scout, and he did a little cattle raising himself. And he also traded in captured Mexican children who had been captured by the Comanches, and he would purchase them from the Comanches and then find their parents and sell them for a bit of a profit. But also, you know, it's partially altruistic and partially an economic deal. He actually adopted several Mexican children whose parents he could not find. And so he had all kinds of different economic activities that he was involved in.
I mean, a life like that, he seems to be a known quantity in the area. I mean, he kind of like a legendary figure at the time.
Right. He was well known in the region. Most of the traders in the area and a good number of the Indian leaders and, of course, governmental officials knew him. So he was well established. You know, he's kind of in the mold of a Kit Carson, who would be far more famous in many ways as a frontiersman. when the Civil War came along, he moved up into the Wichita, Kansas area, helped establish the community of Wichita, Kansas. And part of that was just to get away from the war. Toward the end of the war and after the war, he worked as a teamster for the federal government to bring goods down to the Indian agencies and the military posts and that kind of thing. And he also established a new trading post for himself right at the beginning of the war at Council Grove, which is present-day southwestern Oklahoma City area. The Council Road is named after Council Grove.
Huh. Yeah.
And so it would be just to the east of the Lake Overholser area. And it was a favorite meeting place for Indians in the area to meet and hold councils, and hence the name. So he opened a trading post there, and he would trade with the Comanches and Kiowas and others as well. But then right after the war, with the trading back and forth to the Council Grove area, he followed a path back and forth to Wichita. So when the Chisholm Trail was named the Chisholm Trail, it was basically for that segment from the North Canadian up to Wichita. And a lot of people knew that Jesse Chisholm had used that route. Now, it was not unique to him either, because whenever these trails were created, it was people who were out in the area exploring, trading.
It's based on geography.
That's right. The terrain and the geography, you're going to follow the path that's going to get you to the least resistance to get someplace.
So these trails could possibly be hundreds of years old.
There's some indication that the Indians had used the trail long before Europeans had arrived and had used this very similar route to what Jesse Chisholm had used. And again, that's true with all of the trails of the West. They generally were the path of least resistance and ease and convenience and so forth.
So they weren't like blazing a brand new trail. They were just kind of reusing an old trail.
And you just happen to be the most famous.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a matter of timing to a certain extent. And I don't know if there's any evidence for this, but an educated guess might be, you know, he died in the spring of 1868 and people heard about it and said, well, we're kind of using his trail. And maybe that was
name after that. Yeah.
Right. Now, I've read that it was about 1870 when they started labeling the entire trail.
Calling.
You guys need to make sure that 23rd becomes Ayers Street after.
Oh, absolutely. Right. I'm sure that'll happen.
Yeah, so, you're the first to use it. Yeah.
When the cattle drives really picked up, how did that work with tribal relations? And how did that work out? Was there mutually beneficial, or was there some friction?
Well, it was both, but initially quite a bit of friction with the five tribes over in eastern Oklahoma, because they had the same issue with Texas fever that the Kansas and Missouri farmers did and ranchers did. So they weren't particularly fond of the main thoroughfare through their country being used. And of course, there was quite a bit of damage to the terrain and the grassland when they passed through, on top of the problem of Texas fever. And the Texans had a habit of rounding up any stray Indian cattle that might be nearby and just, you know, why not just put them in with your herd and head them north and sell them free money there. So the Indians at least accused them of doing that. And then the five tribes began charging money for them going through. And that's one reason that there were various branches of the original Sedalia or Shawnee trails that began branching off other directions away from the five tribes area. And that's why the Chisholm Trail was more attractive. It didn't go through there. By 1866, with the Reconstruction Treaties, the five tribes had given up the areas in central and western Oklahoma, and Chisholm Trail went through that area that they had given up.
So there's like a duty-free zone almost.
Yeah, right.
Because it seems that we go from the early cattle drives as almost young upstarts to be at, by 71 to 73, when it's at its peak, to almost be like
a large corporation.
Yeah, as those cattlemen in Texas became more and more prosperous, they would buy up land in Texas and enlarge their herds. And so quite often the Burnett family, the Wheeler family, and others of that sort would naturally gain more control and probably had the larger herds that went through. But there was still plenty of competition. And if you made drives to the north, another factor was that more railroads were building, or the Kansas Pacific was opening up new towns beyond the original railhead at Abilene. And then the Santa Fe began building a parallel line farther south. And so that opened up towns like Wichita and Newton and Ellsworth to the cattle business as well. So it wasn't just the competition among cattlemen, it was the competition among buyers and the railroads along with that. But when the real monopolization began was when the industry began expanding and beyond Central and South Texas, and other lands began opening up, and that's where the big cattle syndicates began gaining more and more control. And a lot of that had to do with the mid-1880s, with the bad weather and lower prices that had occurred and so forth, and the bad weather that wiped out much of the open range business. And so the big operations would always, like, it's a truism, if you have more money, you have more power, so they dominated, but still enough competition. Now, an interesting thing would be the MK&T Railroad arrived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in 1872. So the question is, why
not just go there?
Why not just put your cattle on the train there? Why continue not only through central Oklahoma with the Chisholm Trail, which closed off by about 1886, and then the Western Cattle Trail, which opened up in 1874 after the railroads had really gotten developed in the Texas area. So why would you keep doing that? And, of course, the answer is economics. If you transported goods out the MK&T, they had somewhat of a monopoly on transporting, so they're going to jack up the price for transporting. Whereas if you go up to the Santa Fe Railroad or the Kansas Pacific or the Union Pacific, even farther north in Nebraska, you'll find cow towns where you can sell the cattle at a much higher price than you would have in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And you didn't have to worry about the expense of transporting them out of Texas that the MK&T was charging you. You just had to hire a few cowboys to drive the herd north and do a little arithmetic, and you could realize you're going to make a bigger profit by doing that.
What was, this is like backing up a little bit, but what was the drive for all of this beef? What was going on? Like all of a sudden everybody wants this meat.
You had a huge growing population at the boom at the end of the Civil War. And you had a pent-up demand for beef, too. During the war, you had rationing and the usual scarcity that occurs during wartime. And so people were wanting the beef because it would increase the quality of their lives. And with the population centers growing rapidly, then the demand was there.
And what would happen once, like, the beef was transported to the east? I mean, where would it go, and what would happen?
Would it go straight to a slaughterhouse?
Yeah, it varied. And, of course, you wanted live beef on the hoof initially, because it was not until a little bit later in the 1880s that they started developing the refrigerated cars. And frozen beef was viewed as being inferior to fresh beef, too. But once you got them to the population areas, then you'd have the slaughterhouses, and then you'd have the population nearby. But once the refrigeration came about, then you had other ways of doing it.
Slaughterhouses could be further out from the population.
Right.
So with all this beef moving in, would that mean like the average person would be able to afford a little bit of beef in the city?
Yes. Or? Yeah. And because you had more and more beef and the expansion of the business, the prices went down, which is really good for the consumer. Mm-hmm. And not so good for the producer.
You mentioned the blizzard of 87. Can you talk about how powerful? I mean, that wiped an
like
entire.
Devastating.
Yeah, how devastating that was.
Yeah, they were actually both in the winter of 85-86 and the winter of 86-87 were both horrific. You had an overpopulation of beef by then. The cattle were so hugely numerous, and the lands had spread where cattle and ranches had spread into the north. And in the early 1880s is when the really booming business, when you had people like Theodore Roosevelt investing and New Englanders and Englishmen and the Dutch investing in these huge cattle ranches. And so they overpopulated, the grass got lean and the cattle got lean, and prices were down. But then you had drought, which worsened the problem with the grasslands, and then horrific winters that were two of the worst on record during that time period, winter of 85, 86, 86, 87. Huge numbers of the cattle died, and they would come out during the spring thaw, particularly in areas up north in Nebraska and the Dakotas, and they'd come out and they'd see the carcasses rotting, thawing out and rotting from and it basically wiped out business, much of the business. Particularly ranchers began saying, we've got to start putting up fences and controlling the number of people, number of cattle per acre that we can raise.
That part of putting up fences also introduces barbed wire, which is another kind of the decline of the Chisholm Trail. Can you talk about how barbed wire, the invention of barbed wire, impacts?
Yeah, you know, the mythology of the West is that farmers wanted barbed wire and cattlemen hated it and wanted to cut it down. Well, they wanted to cut it down if farmers were putting it up and keeping them from grazing lands that were public domain. But ranchers themselves used barbed wire to, particularly after that 86-87 winter, to fence in smaller numbers and more scientifically manage the herds. But once they started dividing land up and fencing it in, once the ranchers began purchasing and otherwise acquiring property and fencing it off, then the trail drives were no longer available, because you'd start fencing off the actual trail itself. And that happened with the Chisholm Trail beginning in the 1870s. They did leave a little path still through the area for a while. But the Cherokees began leasing their Cherokee Outlet region in the northern portion of Oklahoma, north central and northwestern Oklahoma, to the Cherokee Strip Livestock Association. And they began fencing in much of that land and that part of the country. This was followed by the Cheyenne Arapaho Reservation doing the same thing, the Kiowa Comanches. The trail driving days were numbered. And there were different branches off the Western Cattle Trail. Western Cattle Trail went through Western Oklahoma, or Dodge City Trails, it's called, because it went to Dodge City. And there were various branches that went off of it as some of the lands began getting fenced in. And there was even a plan to build a national cattle trail that would remain open, that would go through what is now the Oklahoma Panhandle. But that fell apart and never came about. And with more and more railroads coming in, it wasn't as essential anyway.
Right. So when would you say would be kind of the end of this trail, like the late 1880s, or
mid,
did it go on for a little bit longer?
About that time that the bad weather came in, the Chisholm Trail was
pretty
well done.
That was about the, yeah.
And then, of course, the Santa Fe Railroad was built in 1886-87 through the area and down into Texas. So
there's no need
another,
to do
yeah,
that.
Another route. But and then, of course, with the opening of the Anasine Lands in 89, it just moot point for sure by then.
So why do you think that it's so romanticized? And, I mean, they still do Chisholm Trail recreations today.
Well, that's a big question. Why is the American West and the cowboy part of our mythology? I don't really know the answer to that, other than, you know, people like...
It's the freedom, I guess.
That's right, yeah. The freedom, the notion of being out of doors. Some of the stuff I've read talked about the Chisholm Trail becoming famous because people like to sing songs about the Chisholm Trail.
Hey, that
so yodeling cowboys, you know. Yeah. So
blame the Sons of the Pioneers. Yeah. Or something.
And probably, like so many things that involve Western imagery, probably even more popular among the British and other Europeans who love coming and pretending to be cowboys or driving Route 66 for that matter.
Mm-hmm. That's, you know, it just popular. Got a little cold here and I'm done already.
Right.
I couldn't spend 3 months outside.
Well, they didn't
driving.
They didn't allow sissies to become.
Yeah.
Cowboys, so. Speaking of the weather. So what would be a normal, like how long would it take to do the entire trail? And did they do this all year long, or did they have to think about the weather?
You thought about the weather. You know, there were advantages and disadvantages. If you start too early in the spring, then you get the spring rains, and that slows you down. So probably the optimum time was late spring to early summer, maybe edging into the middle of summer. If you get into drought conditions, that's a problem in the heat. So it was all a balancing act. And similar to ranching and farming today, the weather is always variable. You don't normally take a couple of months to go from Texas, central Texas, up to, let's say, Wichita or Abilene. It was not an enjoyable task in many ways, too. One of the things that I've discovered over the years is that, in my reading, is that often you might be the last herd. Maybe you got off late in a season. You had the problem of following a trail that already the grass had been eaten, so your cattle weren't fattening up very much to begin with. And then let's say you approach the boundary of Kansas. And this would be true with the Western Cattle Trail in particular, even approach the boundary of Kansas. You might send a cowboy up to Dodge City to find out what the price was. And by then, the market was flooded because you also had huge numbers of herds that had headed north and so the market was flooded. All the meatpacking plants were full. And so if you decided to bed down for the winter, you could let some of your cowboys go, have a handful of them there in the Cherokee outlet. This would be before the Cherokees started renting it out. And you could bed them down for the winter. And then the spring would come, grass would get green, and they would fatten up. And then they would head to Dodge City, and they'd be the first herd to arrive in Dodge City.
And you could make up for the...
Right, yeah. And easily make up for paying the cowboys a few dollars a month for being bedded down for the winter. And again, you just take pencil to paper and do the arithmetic, and you'd figure, man, if we can just do this. And now you would be taking a risk, too, because you might lose a large number of cattle during the winter, that kind of thing, drifting away or dying because of the elements. But it seemed to be a strategy that would work. And then, of course, as time went by, the ranges began opening up in that part of the country anyway.
Did you ever watch Bonanza growing up?
No, my grandfather did, and I just didn't like it.
Really? I loved watching Bonanza.
I couldn't, there was two, so some of them were in black and white, right?
Yeah,
and then there were color, I could never figure out, is it a long story, or is each episode a standalone? I could never figure it out. It would be like getting into Dallas.
No.
Season four.
You can watch any Bonanza, and it wouldn't be like, I don't know what's going on. It's not like a soap opera.
There was another. There was Bonanza. What was the other big Western show?
There's Gunsmoke.
See, yeah.
That was a big one. I wasn't really into Gunsmoke, but I really loved Bonanza.
What was Bonanza? What was the premise?
Well, it was a handsome older man and his sons, and they had a ranch, the Ponderosa Ranch.
Okay.
And they were cattle ranchers.
Where?
Just, out west.
Was it that
vague? On Ponderosa. I'm guessing it was probably California. I'm sure it wasn't, but since I was a child, I wasn't really paying attention to, the actual...
Well, no, but, not where it was filmed. I'm sure it was California.
No, I may have actually even been in California. It was pretty, kind of desert.
Okay.
Looking, huh. So...
Yeah,
But Hoss and Little Joe, and yeah.
They were some just cute boys. Was that part of the allure?
Well, the cutest one would have been Michael Landon.
Oh yeah,
when he was young. So
see, Michael Landon to me is Highway to Heaven. So that's the only Michael Landon.
Yeah, Wild Wild West. Loved Wild 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 West.
I don't. You're really? Not much older than I am, and you're acting like my grandmother.
These were all reruns. I watched all the reruns, like on MKUT 43 or something like that. No, I just
back when you on the second dial, it was below the top.
Flip the dials with my feet so I wouldn't have to get up.
Speaking of Gunsmoke and stuff like that, next episode is going to be loosely about the Chisholm Trail, but it's going to be like what was being a cowboy all about?
Yeah, it was funny because I didn't think that I would be that into this subject. And I had all these questions come to think of it, which I guess makes sense since it is, I was obsessed with Bonanza and other cowboy shows.
Hold on. Like Young Guns and Young Guns 2. That was my...
Those were okay, but that's something I wouldn't watch all the time.
Well, they're movies, so there's not as many of them. How many seasons? How many episodes?
Oh, good
I bet
Lord,
there were
like Bonanza?
Ungodly amount of episodes.
Probably.
Of Bonanza.
I don't even know how many years that was on.
We're going to do some research.
Yeah, we'll have to look at that.
Well, thanks for listening to the podcast, everyone. If you enjoy it, write us a positive review on iTunes.
Yeah, and look us up on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're on Instagram now. All of the photos that we're posting are part of the Oklahoma Historical Society collection. So there's some really cool ones.
Yep. What's
I don't know.
What's goodbye in cowboy?
What would that be? I don't know.
See you later.
Get along, little doggy.
Yeah, how do you sing, what's the...
Yippee-i-yo.
So I don't know. End of the trail, isn't that
End of the trail. Happy trails
happy
to you.
Happy trails
there you go.
To you. Until
we meet again.